From WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. I'm producer Megan Mack, alongside host Devin Dawson, who is back from vacation this week.
Did you miss me last week?
I did.
Oh,
I did Weekend Connections all by myself last
week. I know. I listened to it. And it's always great to come back. I always take the longest daylight week of the year off. That's true, because I love the solstice. I love getting up early in the morning. I love when the sun is down late. It's also nice to come back to Jazz Fest week. The city is so great this time of year. And you've actually been out. You've done a few live remotes. What do we call those? Live remotes? Live hits?
That's what we call them in TV. So we'll just keep calling them that in radio.
One day, Megan and I are going to figure out what the terminology is in radio, like 10 years in.
Yeah, we'll get it eventually.
It's at least cool to see the city like that, isn't it?
It is. And I had a great experience the last time. I met a lot of very interesting people and a dog who ran up to me during the live report. So it sounded a little clunky on air because I was dealing with a menacing 3-pound terrier.
Three-pound terrier. Well, no, it has been a good week. And unfortunately, as we always do in Connections, we've got a mix. But I say unfortunately, sometimes you got to cover tragedy. Boy, and this week we saw another devastating terror attack, this time at the Istanbul airport in Turkey. Three attackers killed 41 people. But unlike the attacks in Paris and Orlando, you really didn't see the outpouring of grief and support around the world. You didn't see Turkish flags on Facebook or social media. And the local Islamic community notices that. They feel the difference. We spoke to the president of the Islamic Center of Rochester, Sarir Fazali, about that.
The amount of, you know, I guess publicity is a bad word, but the amount of coverage being given to this event seems rather muted as compared to some of the other rather sensational terror attacks that have occurred recently, whether they were in Florida or other parts of Europe. And the concern that some of us have is Turkey is a Muslim country. And the idea that when these things happen in Muslim countries, that they may not be as important or relevant to the world as if they happen here in the States or in other parts of Europe is a significant concern for us. Because, you know, a day or two before the attacks in Paris, there was an attack in Beirut in Lebanon.
One day.
And the difference in the responses from the world and the press was literally night and day. So our concern is that people have to understand, the media and everybody else concerned have to realize that Muslims, presuming that the group behind this attack was an ISIS or some typical organization, people have to realize that it is the Muslim population in the Muslim countries that are being grossly affected in hundreds of thousands of numbers, whether it's lives and injuries and even, you know, loss to the economies, than anywhere else. Muslims are still the first target of these terrorists. I remember the attack in Pakistan specifically. I think it was Easter Sunday, if I'm not mistaken. And there were families, Christian families, living in Pakistan celebrating in those parks. And it made news, and then it was gone. And there was no, as you said, outpouring or embracing of the country, much as we saw with Paris or even Brussels after that attack. And it is concerning because the more that this happens, the less importance is given to one of our fundamental teachings, is that human life is a human life, whether it's a Muslim, a non-Muslim, whatever it is. And there is no favoritism when it comes to how Muslims believe in the loss of a human life. We are all the same. And when these things happen, and the, you know, in your words, in your quick research, when you see the response that's being given by the world over, it leaves an indelible mark, unfortunately, on us that we may not count as much as others do.
Turning to news out of Washington now, the Obama administration announced last week that for the first time in more than 20 years, prison inmates will be eligible to receive Pell Grants to pay for college. The debate over taxpayer-funded education programs for inmates isn't a new one, but studies show that every dollar spent on higher education for prisoners saves $4 or $5 in costs in the criminal justice system.
So we welcomed Dr. Ed Wiltsey from Nazareth College. He created the JAIL program, which brings together college students and inmates to discuss literature. And we were also joined by Dr. Joshua Dubler, who's leading a prison-to-college program at the University of Rochester. And Josh says the public's perception of criminal justice needs to change.
Most of us live in a retributive logic in which, what is it that victims need? they need their assailants to suffer. And that's a fairly primitive logic, and it's a zero-sum logic, and I question whether that helps victims or assailants.
A criminal justice process that actively seeks to engage both the offender and the victim in a dialogue that enables them to come to a common story of what happened and what the consequences of that event are. That's something that we're pushing for nationally and in multiple settings. We release 600,000 people a year from U.S. jails and prisons, and we are making choices about what those folks will have the opportunity to do when they're released on the basis of what we provide them while they're locked up. If we provide an environment that perpetuates the sort of norm of U.S. jails and prisons of violence, boredom, and noise, then those folks will come out reflective of what they experienced inside. If we provide a modicum of education and perhaps a future in a career, then those folks will come out reflective of that.
This topic raised an important question. What can we do to help reduce the number of young people who find themselves caught in the cycle of violence that leads to prison? Well, this week we talked to leaders of local programs that help at-risk kids get their first job and graduate from high school.
In this clip, you'll hear from Shantara Randall, a program coordinator for the Center for Teen Empowerment. She started at the center as a youth organizer 10 years ago, and she says teen empowerment provides opportunities for kids who are the most likely to fall through the cracks because they have nowhere else to turn.
We hire a wide variety of young people. So we may hire a young person who is on track to go to college and is doing extremely well in life. And then we may hire a young person who's just standing on the corner the day before. And we provide those young people with an opportunity to not only make money and be able to help and support, because we also, just alone in this year, we have two young people who have children already in the program. We have a young man who has a 2-year-old daughter, and we have a 16-year-old young lady who has a 5-year-old. And so we're dealing with those young people. We're working with those schedules and helping them to balance out those. So we hire a wide variety of young people. And so more young people come to teen empowerment because they realize that, you know, we're not judging them on what their past is or, you know, how well they're doing in school, but we try to connect them to school. So once you become a part of teen empowerment, then we encourage you to get into a program or go to school. So we get young people who are on the verge of dropping out or who may have already dropped out, and we attempt to connect those young people to different organizations and programs to be able to assist them in getting back on track.
I mean, think about that. Think about being in your teenage years, having a child, maybe being on the verge of dropping out. You get that job, and maybe that changes everything for you. You've seen that, right?
Oh, I've seen it on countless occasions. You know, our young people, what they want is an opportunity. They want not just an opportunity, but like Antoine spoke about, a caring adult. You don't understand how many interviews that I've been in where I'll ask what's going on or what's happening, and a young person will like pour out their whole life story and all of the struggles that they've encountered and endured in their life. And they're like, thank you. Because nobody really ever asked me why I am the way that I am. And a lot of times, young people are crying out for help. They're crying out for opportunities. And sometimes they're getting ignored, especially when you're not connected to those programs. Like, some of our young people don't qualify for Hillside Work Scholarship. Some of our young people don't qualify for the Summer of Opportunities. I had an opportunity to do Summer of Opportunities. And some of our young people don't qualify for those things. So we're giving them an opportunity to reconnect, because we know that it is the disconnected young people that oftentimes result in criminal activities are being constantly and consistently labeled within our community.
Now let's turn to a conversation about a new film that some critics have said is the best political documentary ever made. I'm talking about the film Wiener, which is, of course, about former U.S. Congressional Representative Anthony Wiener.
The film is sort of a behind-the-scenes look at Anthony Wiener's catastrophic run for mayor in 2013. That's when news of his second sexting scandal broke in the media, effectively derailing what could have been a promising political career. We had a lot to talk about with our panel, including how the media covers political scandals. In the film, Wiener agrees to appear on Lawrence O'Donnell's MSNBC show, The Last Word. Here's what happened.
What I'm trying to get at, Anthony, is what drives you.
Okay,
Anthony, I mean it from a psychiatric level.
Dude,
I don't care
about
your
phony
political answers.
Dude, I don't really need your psychiatric questions.
I don't care about your phony political answers.
Do an interview here. Do an interview.
You are being driven by some kind of demons in some strange directions.
Lawrence, do you want to ask me a question, or do you have me on a harangue with a split screen? This can't be good TV for anybody.
We asked our panel why they thought Wiener reacted in this way. You're going to hear from Dr. Kathleen Donovan, a political science professor at St. John Fisher College. But first, here's Dr. Hinda Mandel from RIT, whose research has focused on political scandals.
I think that might be along the lines of a narcissist, and obviously I have no training in that whatsoever, but I've spoken to some psychologists and psychotherapists about narcissism in relation to sex scandal for my research, and they speak about these narcissistic wounds that people, including politicians are people, I guess, have during their childhood, where they've been wounded, neglected, abused, and they're seeking intimacy, but they don't feel comfortable getting a healthy type of intimacy. They don't know what healthy intimacy is. For them, intimacy is really harmful. It caused them wrong. And so they want attention, but they want it in the wrong ways. They want love, but they don't know how to make themselves vulnerable. So they act out in a hyper, stimulated way, oftentimes with, sexual compulsion.
Dr. Donovan, what did you make of that interaction between Anthony Weiner and Lawrence O'Donnell?
Yeah, interestingly, I sort of got a different take on it. Yeah, he was laughing, sort of watching it afterwards, but in my mind, it was much more of he recognized sort of where he was at and that this was potentially unsalvageable. He does admit at one point, that he really screwed it up, essentially. And absolutely, he should have a canned response. And I think he gave the canned response over and over and over again. And he just finally reached a breaking point. Obviously, he lacks some impulse control. And I think we saw that, too, later when he tried to make a policy proposal, which, go figure, I don't remember what he was talking about. And he kept asking the media, any questions about this? Any questions that are on topic?
Yeah.
And it was just dead silent. And then finally, he opens it up. And all they want to ask him about is the scandal. And so I think that was a very powerful moment to see how much power the media can have in driving the narrative. And that even when he wants to move past, he can't.
I think that's a canny observation on the media. And Kathleen, as someone who has researched this intersection of the way the public responds to political behavior, I look at that O'Donnell interview and I see someone who, this former congressman, who used these kind of moments to build his fame and then didn't really know how to do it any other way to try to get out of it. Because that was his style when he was in Congress that made him popular.
Right.
He was combative. He would fight for progressive causes. He was not afraid to yell and to stick it back in someone's face. I don't think this moment called for that, but I see in this case someone who doesn't understand how any other way to play the game, and I'm looking at this going, Anthony, what are you doing? But I wouldn't have gone on that show in the first place, because that's not real journalism.
Yeah, that's a great question. Why did he agree to the interview in the first place? I mean, he had to know that that was going to be what was going to be talked about. But I think that's an interesting point. If that's the only way he knows how to deal with issues, and that's what has drawn a lot of his supporters, is being impassioned and sticking up for himself and the things that he believes in, then, why not try that strategy? Maybe it'll work.
So after hearing all of that, it might make sense as to why Wiener allowed filmmakers to follow him around. But in January, he told the New York Post that he regrets it and he doesn't plan to watch the film. But if you'd like to see it, it's screening at the Little Theater. For showtimes, just visit thelittle.org.
All right, let's end the week with a question that continues to create conversation in our community. Does downtown Rochester need a new performing arts center?
Arnie Rothschild is the president of the Rochester Broadway Theater League. He's in favor of a new performing arts center for a number of reasons, but in this clip, he talks about why a new center would put Rochester on the map for the touring version of a Broadway show that maybe you've heard of. It's called Hamilton.
As Hamilton began to look at their road tour, they started looking at theater capacities. And as you know, I've been talking for a long time about my concern about the size of the auditorium theater. And so they made a list based on theater capacities of towns that they would go to, because Hamilton obviously is the hottest product that's been on Broadway in many years. Rochester was on the second page of the list because it's only 2,460 seats. So you have Buffalo at well over 3,000. Let's just, kind of do the math. If you had an additional 400 seats in Buffalo and 8 performances, although in the case of Hamilton, most probably you look at a 2 or 3 week run. So let's say 16 performances. All of a sudden there's 6,400 more seats to sell. It costs the same to ship the show, house the show, feed the show, stage the show. So Rochester loses by virtue of the fact that our venue is too small. We're on the second page of that tour.
Okay, well, I think this is an arts town. It's a theater town. But I think there's also, based on the history of Rochester in our region, a skepticism among taxpayers about big outlays of taxpayer dollars on big public projects. And I know there are multiple possibilities here for a performing arts center, some of which include big public money, some of which do not. But if public money is required here, you think that that is a good way to spend tax dollars?
If you're talking about capital expenditure money, I do. If you were talking about subsidy, I don't. Here's the difference in my mind. We have to do something to rebuild our downtown. In Rochester, New York, like this or not, and I apologize to everyone, there's never been a major capital expenditure project that was done that didn't involve Eastman Kodak, Xerox, or Bausch & Lomb. And so a lot of people of my age who should have been doing these major capital expenditure projects in the past haven't done them. And if you're rebuilding your downtown, a performing arts center in the middle of downtown, I think, is a good capital expenditure. But I would also point to the fact that we have no problem in New York State building football stadiums to be used 8 or 9 weeks a year. We have no problem spending $2 billion to build 2 baseball stadiums in New York City. We have no problem spending south of $70 million to build an amphitheater near the fairgrounds in Syracuse. And yet we argue about whether or not it's a good use of capital expenditure dollars to build a performing arts center that would change the nature of our downtown and cause people to move in and rebuild the tax base. So I think it's a very worthwhile capital expenditure. I don't believe it's going to need an operating subsidy, nor would I agree with one.
All right, that's Arnie Rothschild from RBTL. And I don't know, the next time we do an interview, I may just say to him, come on, man, we're not getting Hamilton. But he says it's possible. I think these things take a long time to go on the road. I was going to ask Megan, you had said that it took Book of Mormon like a few years to go on the road. Right?
I think it did.
We got it here in Rochester.
And you saw it, didn't you?
But it goes on the road while it's still on Broadway, right?
I believe so.
Okay, see, look, this is why not... like non-theater experts, like I should not be diving into this. But the bottom line is that show could probably sell out for 20 years before it goes on the road. I don't know if it ever comes here. Arnie Rothschild clearly thinks that 3,000-seat magic number matters. And we'll see, because that will be a discussion that has to go on throughout the summer as they start to work toward proposals. And that's it for this edition of Weekend Connections. You can hear Connections every weekday afternoon from noon to 2 on WXXI AM 1370, WRUR 88.5 FM, and WEOS 89.5 FM Finger Lakes Public Radio.
You can also tune in on WXXI.org/listen and on the WXXI mobile app. I'm Megan Mack.
I'm Evan Dawson. Have a great holiday weekend. We're back with you on Tuesday.